to talk this morning about two fundamental truths. In fact, it's called the doctrine of the two truths. I taught this summer, and then I will teach again with Genko this fall on the way of the Bodhisattva and chapter 10, ultimate chapter about wisdom, is all about the two truths. Two fundamental truths that really Mahayana Buddhism is, takes very seriously. And those two truths are relative truth and ultimate truth. Both of those things are true, Buddhism says. The relative truth is the truth of ourself, the truth of the everyday world. You could see it maybe even as karmic truth. One cause leads to a result, an effect. And we learn that, you know, little by little as people, how the relative world works. Hopefully we learn that and how to negotiate that. But this second truth is the ultimate truth, and that is the world, the truth of no self, of emptiness. The truth that is, you could say, before the truth of relative truth. And the only way to experience that truth, to get to know that truth, is to let go of relative truth. So it's harder to find than relative truth. The only way to find it is to drop ourself. And in this beautiful morning like this morning, that's what we do. We drop ourselves as best we can. And one way to conceive of that is we are learning something about ultimate truth. That's a big part of our practice. And getting an intuitive feeling for ultimate truth is a place that we try to go in this practice. And realizing, not only feeling that with our intuition, but also realizing that the two exist, coexist, that they exist together, they both exist. And you could say they both exist within you. Today I really want to talk more about truth than about help. Last week I talked about anger. What else was that about? Anger. And at least that's what it was supposed to be about. But, and you know, there are many ways to approach Zen. Ways in which Zen practice can help one in one's life. That's one way to talk about Zen. But another way to approach Zen, to talk about Zen, what I want to talk about today, is this. I won't talk so much today about how this is going to help you. Today's talk is more about how it is. And that's an important aspect of Zen practice too. No matter whether it helps you directly in this or that everyday experience or not. Though it may, I hope it does. But this kind of truth aspect, we have to do that, take that journey without wanting to get better at anything. In particular, not wanting to get any better at any specific thing. We're just doing it because it feels right to get to the truth. And in some ways, I think, in order to do it fully and honestly, we have to give up hope. And then, you know, in our everyday life, it may have some effect. That's a different conversation. But it might be when, for instance, my son spills the milk all over my important papers that are on the kitchen table. There are two ways to look at that. One is knowing the importance of those papers and realizing and wondering, how have I raised a child that would do such a thing as this? Let's go back. Where did we make a mistake? And where did I make a mistake? Leaving those important papers on the table. How did this happen? And what are the consequences of this going to be for the future? How are they going to dry out? That's one way to experience life. And there is also just milk on the table and drip, drip, drip onto the floor. That is also a reality. What is the percentage chance, just to get scientific about it? Wes is here, I thought I'd be a little scientific. What is the percentage chance that I will feel something of that reality in that moment? I don't know how that reality is going to affect me. Maybe I'll be sad. Maybe I'll feel happy, released, light. I don't know. But what chance is there that I will feel some of that in that moment? That's one of the reasons we do this practice, I think. But as I said, in order to, whatever effect that has, in order to sense that aspect of reality, we have to do this job, we have to do this practice of just letting ourselves go and not trying to be any better, not having any hope, just sitting and experiencing. And over time, we can feel this is a part of ourselves and really kind of know that it's a part of ourselves. I think there's a lot of stories. I'm not sure if I chose the right one. But here's a story about somebody who knew that he had this other aspect. It's a story about a king who sends his son, the prince, off to get educated when he becomes a teenager. Sends him with a lot of money to the very best teacher, very wise and good teacher, and warrior. So he sends him off, and after some years, the teacher gives the prince 5 weapons. So the prince gets known as Prince 5 Weapon. And so Prince 5 Weapon comes back, is traveling back to go to see his father after all this time. And on his way back, the road goes through a wood, dark wood. And the folks in the town say, don't go through there, Prince Five Weapon, because Sticky Hair lives in that wood, and he eats everything he sees. Avoid that wood. Well, Prince Five Weapon is not going to avoid that wood. He's not going to avoid anything. He feels strong. He has the courage of a lion. So he enters the wood. And wouldn't you know it, after a little while, he meets Sticky Hair. Now, Sticky Hair is a fearsome-looking chap. There's different descriptions of him, but one says he's as big as a palm tree, with a head of as big as a small house, and ugly yellow teeth, and blue hands and feet, with hair all over him. Eyes big as alms bowls. And Sticky Hair says, aha, I have my lunch. And Five Weapon says, not so fast, Sticky Hair. I have many weapons. You should, and I will slay you. So he takes out his first two weapons, which are a bow and a poison arrow, and he shoots it at Sticky Hair. And the arrow whoosh, hits Sticky Hair, but gets stuck in the hair and can't get through. And so he shoots 50 of these arrows, none of them. They all stick to the hair. So he gets out his next weapon, which is his 3-foot sword, and he strikes Sticky Hair with it. The sword just gets stuck in the hair. And then he gets his spear and tries that, and he gets stuck, and it's just a big mess. And then his last one is a club, and he bangs him with the club, and it just sticks to him. Well, he's undeterred, Prince Five Weapon. He is courageous, and he socks him with his left hand, and his hand sticks. And he socks him with his right hand, and then he kicks him with his left, and he kicks him with his right. And finally, he headbutts him. Yeah. And he's stuck in 5 places to Sticky Hair. And yet, he is calm, even though. And he is not afraid. And Sticky Hair can sense this. So instead of immediately devouring him, he thinks he'll ask more questions before he devours him. And he says, why aren't you afraid of me? And Prince Five Weapon says, He says, why aren't you afraid of death? And Prince Five Weapon says, I know, because I know that everything that is born will die. And then he says something, the Sticky Hair nods. And then Prince Five Weapon says, and also, Sticky Hair, I should tell you, you may eat me, that's fine, but I have a diamond in my belly. Some translates a diamond, sometimes it's a thunderbolt. I have a diamond in my belly. And when you eat me, that diamond will cut you up. So go ahead. We'll both die together. And Sticky Hair decides to I don't know how he does it, but somehow he decides to unstick Prince Five Weapon. And bow down to Prince Five Weapon. And Prince Five Weapon then teaches him the way of the Dharma. And Sticky Hair then, over time, turns into a fairy nymph, wood nymph. So he calms him, tames him. Well, Prince Five Weapon knew, you know, he tried everything. He tried all kinds of things with his five weapons, maybe your senses, you know. I mean, if Sticky Hair, we could go into what Sticky Hair, I don't want to get too far off, but Sticky Hair being, you know, your cravings, your desires. He tried all these things and then remembered that he had this. Or maybe he knew it all along. He had this sixth weapon, which was inside of him, which made him courageous and calm. That knowledge, I think, we call Buddha nature, knowing your Buddha nature, knowing your no-self nature. You could also call it God self, perhaps. And we, as practitioners, have to know that we are both. We are both our personal self, and we are also this divine, we also have this divine, sparkling nature. In Christianity, it's called, they say that Jesus Christ is both God and man, God and human. And according to Joseph Campbell, last year I reread up the first half of Hero with a Thousand Faces. And in that he talks about the sign of the cross as a symbol of this divine nature, the vertical, meeting our human nature, the horizontal. The horizontal represents the world, working the world, moving around in the world. The vertical axis is the divine axis. It's stopping. It cuts through that. This is the horizontal is time. This the vertical cuts through that. And when we sit vertically, that's what we do. We're connecting with that divine nature, which is outside of regular time. I appreciate that metaphor. We, in this practice, are to realize that we are both God. We have both God nature and human nature. That both of those natures are okay. But we have to know, we have to recognize them both. And that, once we realize that, we can feel the alternating. You know, in Buddhist texts, they say 84,000 times a second. Well, I don't know if I can do it, figure it that fast. But the alternating, vibrating between those two that are always with us. And we can behold spilled milk in both those ways. which I haven't even gotten to the Word becoming flesh, so here we go. It comes from a supporter of our center and poet Leonard Cohen, our poet laureate, I sometimes say, has a song called The Window. And this is a line that comes to me now and then, so I thought I'd share it with you. I'll try to sing it. Yeah. And it's about giving up yourself. Well, you'll see what it's about. You'll figure it out. He's so poetical. Then lay your rose on the fire. The fire give up to the sun. The sun give over to splendor in the eyes of the High Holy One. For the Holy One dreams of a letter, dreams of a letter's death. Oh, bless the continuous stutter of the Word being made into flesh. The rhythm, we say, of the world is this rhythm between self and no self, between ultimate and relative. The rhythm of our lives, when we can feel it, when we get a sense for it, an intuitive sense for it, is this rhythm. And that's not just a rhythm that we Buddhists have to ourselves, I don't think. This intersection between God and human is something that all the great traditions talk about. We talk about it in our own way. And it's our job, one of our jobs as practitioners, is to realize that deep truth.